Well, the good news is that I got a joke. The bad news, it ain't funny. Well, I don't think it's funny. You can tell me what you think. Reading here from the Memoirs of Australian Soldiers. Typical of the laconic humor of the times was the story about the wounded Jap who said to the Aussie in a sarcastic tone, "You think you're going to be home for Christmas?" To which the digger replied, "And you think you're going to the hospital?" See, it's not very funny, is it? And you're sitting there thinking, gee, that's not very nice. And it's true. A lot of what I have to tell you today is not very nice. But perhaps some of you are also there sitting there thinking, it's not very nice, but hopefully it's an exception. Hopefully this wasn't part of some pattern in the Australian military during the Pacific War. But there is a pattern, and we find it as soon as we go and look at the memoirs. Ken Clift is one writer of memoirs. He says that after a victory at Oyvi in Papua New Guinea, very few of the enemy escaped. Many surrendered and were exterminated. A veteran of Finchhoffen tells how a barge was intended to transport Australian wounded and a prisoner, but it didn't turn up. And so two Australians took the Japanese prisoner into the jungle. He says, "Shortly afterwards, I heard the unmistakable crack of a rifle. Later, I passed one of those men and asked, 'What happened to the little Jap?' He looked at me steadily for some seconds and then replied, 'The nip. Oh, he shot through, mate. Yeah, he got away.'" Now, why am I talking about this? Obviously, at one level, it's just to put the biggest dent I can in the sepia-toned romantic image we've got of the Australian war effort in World War II, is this wonderful crusade. What I don't want to do is focus on blaming the individual soldiers, because by and large, they were victims of circumstance. They were drawn into a cycle of fear and hate. "You can't fight this war without hate," wrote the war correspondent Osmar Wilde. "If you don't hate enough, you're going to be beaten." So this cycle of fear and hate, but what that is really is just an ideological reflection of something far more important, substantial, which is a cycle of imperialist conflict between the great powers that had built up in Asia over several decades. And that's really the first thing I want to talk about today, is the imperialist nature of the war from all sides. And related to that, I'll touch a little bit on racism, which is the key ideological prop of an imperialist war. But then I will get onto the happier territory of resistance to the evils of the Pacific War as well. So where do we start? Well, the conventional place to start a discussion of the Pacific War is Pearl Harbor, and that's very convenient for Western ideologues because, you know, the Japanese started it, didn't they? It all started at Pearl Harbor, and so they get the blame. It's very convenient. But actually, it makes more sense to go back to 1853, which is when Commodore Perry from the United States arrived off the coast of Japan with a fleet of warships to force the Japanese government to open its borders. Now, until then, the Tokugawa regime had kept the country sealed up. Western imperialism was no longer prepared to accept this, demanding that the Japanese open up, and of course they succeeded. And this set off alarm bells running throughout Japan, because they didn't have to look very far. They just had to look at their neighbors to see what had happened to other countries that had been forced open by imperialism. A samurai, just for example, visited Shanghai, and he wrote about it. He said, "Here, most of the Chinese have become the servants of foreigners. When English and French people come walking, the Chinese give way. It is really nothing but a colony of England and France. We've been warned. Who can be sure the same fate will not visit our country in future?" So if you're the Japanese ruling class, what do you do about this? You need the strongest, most powerful military you can manage to confront this threat from Western imperialism. To have a powerful military, you need an industrial base. For an industrial base, you need raw materials, which Japan really didn't have many of. So you need colonies in Asia. And so you can see how it's Perry's visit that sets off a process that leads to the growth of Japanese imperialism and a Japanese empire, which is essentially an imitation of the empires of the West. And after that, of course, there's a long, complicated history of diplomacy and warfare and contention throughout the Asia-Pacific that I can't spend a lot of time on. But I want to touch on two aspects of it I think are really important. One is the specifically Australian angle, and the other is the events leading up directly to Pearl Harbor. Something else was happening in 1853 when Perry turned up off Japan, and that was a gold rush in Australia, which generated a vast amount of wealth, a vast amount of capital, which then is looking for investment outlets. And this is the point after the gold rushes, is where you start to hear voices suggesting that the Australian colonies, or together maybe with the British, should go out and seize more territory in the Pacific. Seize Fiji, take the New Hebrides off the French, invade and occupy New Guinea. And in other words, we begin to see the dynamic of what would eventually become a specifically Australian imperialism. But this, in turn, raises the prospect of conflict, because you're going to bump up against rivals, aren't you, in the Pacific? And there are many possibilities for the, you know, the role of rival. There were the French, there were the Americans even, there were the Russians. But the most obvious place for a clash was with Japan, because Japan was the imperial rival. There was one imperial rival that was likely to raise a challenge to that essential pillar of Australian culture and civilization, white Australia. Japanese were likely to threaten this in some way. And this has a lot to do with why Australia was so heavily involved in the First World War. You know, actually, Australia had more casualties in the First War than the Second. Why is this? Why, you know, there's many reasons. It has to do with imperial markets, and there are various factors. But one significant factor is the issue of defending white Australia. And Billy Hughes is quite clear on this. He says, if we don't get support from the British Empire against the Japanese, we'll be in trouble. And he says, actually, I have a quote here from him. He says, Japan would challenge the white Australia policy after the war. Australia would need the help of the Empire. And to be sure of getting it, she must throw her full strength into the war in Europe. So you see, when you and I look at Gallipoli, we see a tragedy. When Billy Hughes and the Australian ruling class looked at all the dead diggers at Gallipoli, they saw bargaining chips. They could go to the British and say, look at the contribution we made, now you back us up against the Japanese. They could go specifically to the Versailles Peace Conference in a strong position at the bargaining table because they had these bargaining chips. And Versailles was the place after the war where the Japanese had their first opportunity to raise an anti-racist resolution, which they did. And it was ferociously opposed, in particular, by the Australian delegation and William Morris Hughes, the Australian Prime Minister. And the Japanese are mortally offended. And so angry are they that President Wilson over in America is worried that the Japanese may withdraw from his pet project, which is the League of Nations. So he has to pacify Japan. So how do you go about that? He facilitates territorial concessions to the Japanese on the Chinese mainland. In other words, Australian racism and imperialism are the starting point for a process that leads to the expansion of the Japanese Empire. It did something else. This aggressive behavior by the Australians did something else. It polarized Japanese opinion, public opinion, around the militarists and the warmongers. And we know this from the comments from the Chief of Australian Intelligence, Major Pies, who said, and I quote, "We have been perhaps the chief factor in consolidating the whole Japanese nation behind the imperialists." An Australian academic, James Murdoch, went off to Japan on a fact-finding mission. He said the same things, and he added, "If we're going out for a scrap, this is just the way to get into one." So you see, Australia has its share of responsibility for these imperialist dynamics. But of course, at the end of the day, the key balance of forces in the Pacific is that between the great powers, and we're talking particularly about the standoff between the United States and Japan, which, put very simply, was about who had controlled China, who had controlled Southeast Asia. And the Americans had decided by about 1940 that they were going to smash Japan. They wanted a war with Japan. They were going to smash the Japanese Empire. The only trouble was the American public did not want a war with Japan. The American public wanted to stay out of war. So it was tremendously important, and the American Defense Secretary Stimson is explicit about this in his diary. It's very important to set up the Japanese so they were seen to strike the first blow. So what was the strategy to do this? They used what today we would call sanctions. The United States was the source of most of Japan's oil. The Americans cut off not all of it. They left them enough to run a fleet, but not enough to fight a war. So they're cornering the Japanese. And the rulers in Tokyo, of course, are acutely aware of this. And they look for a strategy to break out somehow. And the strategy they hit upon was to strike south to seize the oil deposits in what today is Indonesia and to keep the Americans at bay long enough to consolidate the position there to attack the fleet at Pearl Harbor. So you can see how, in fact, the Japanese were set up. They appear to be the aggressors, but in fact, it's all imperialist aggression on both sides. And in case you think I'm misrepresenting the background of Pearl Harbor, I'll read to you from a British Admiralty intelligence report, which says, had she not gone to war now, Japan would have seen such a deterioration of her economic position as to render her ultimately unable to wage war and to reduce her to the status of a second-rate power. Joseph Rochford, intelligence commander for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, said similarly, we cut off their money, fuel, and trade. We were just tightening the screws on the Japanese. They could see no way of getting out except going to war. So I think you can see now this is an imperialist conflict on all sides. But imperialism seldom presents itself as such, you know? Like, They don't generally come out the imperialists and say, we're the imperialists, we're tough, we kick butt. I mean, George Bush might say that, but he's an idiot, right? In general, what they do is they present imperialist war as a noble crusade for democracy, don't they? And sure enough, therefore, when the war breaks out and John Curtin, the Australian Prime Minister, is setting out the Australian war objectives, he puts it this way. He says, we're at war with Japan because our vital interests are imperiled and because the rights of free people in the whole Pacific are assailed. Isn't this an amazing statement? The free peoples of the Pacific, who on earth is that? Right? Was Indonesia free? We have ruled here for 300 years with the whip and the club, said the Dutch governor of Java in 1935. Were the Philippines free? In fact, they had been conquered by the United States in a war of imperialist aggression anyway. Brutal war, so vicious, in fact, that the humorist Mark Twain suggested the Americans needed a new flag, one with skull and crossbones instead of the stars, and painted all the stripes black. But what of Australia's territories? What of the people in Asia, the quite free people of Asia ruled by Australia? Well, just one example. There was a strike in Rabaul in Papua New Guinea in 1929. It's Australian territory, colonial territory. And we know the response of the white rulers because some of it seems to have been written down. I quote, "My coon's not here." There was no response from the slave. The government is disgustingly lenient with the natives. Why, the only thing a native understands is a beating. So there you have the reality of the free peoples of the Pacific. And so it's not surprising, therefore, that when the Japanese won those initial victories in the war and they marched through Asia, they were incredibly popular in some places. There were a lot of people who welcomed the Japanese as liberators from the white oppressors. Now, they soon discovered that Japanese imperialism was no nicer than any other imperialism and turned against the Japanese. But even so, there was a clear understanding that the defeat of the white Europeans was a landmark on leading to the process which would eventually lead to decolonization. And even people, local leaders in Asia who were hostile to Japan, nevertheless understood this point. A guy called Dato' Bin Jaafar, a Malay leader, said, "Under the Japanese, I learned that a nation is just as good as a European. The Japanese were brutal, true, but they inspired us with a new idea of what Asia might become." And, of course, the European, and including Australia, the Western imperialists are acutely aware of this dynamic at work. And so the second half of the war became an exercise in marching back through Asia and restoring what the British leader Anthony Eden had referred to as white man authority. And to restore white man authority, what did this mean for Australia specifically? And that Australian troops went into eastern Indonesia, where they facilitated the return of the Dutch colonialists, including, most notably, a guy called Paul Westerling, who is probably the most brutal figure in the entire history of Dutch imperialism, facilitated his return to Indonesia, where he then proceeded to go into villages, round people up, demand to know the heads of the local Indonesian independence movement. If they would give them to him, he'd shoot somebody, he'd line up some more people, he'd shoot someone else. So effective was this with the backup of the Australian military that it was transferred as well to Java and used by the Dutch more widely. So that's one role of Australia in restoring, Western imperialism. The other thing the Australians were trying to do, although they don't seem to have been all that successful at it, was seize territory in the Pacific. And we know this because the American ambassador wrote to Washington and said, this Doc Evatt guy, who's the Australian foreign minister, he wants to consolidate Australian domination up to the equator. And that was the objective. Okay, so again, an imperialist war on all sides. And that means one of its key ideological pillars is racism, because if you're going to invade somebody's country and kick them around and rip them off, you need an ideology that tells you that this is okay, because they are inferior to you. And so sure enough, when John Curtin is setting out and the government was setting out in Australia the war aims in early 1942, there's a specific reference to the principle of a white Australia. And John Curtin says, from the day that Captain Arthur Phillip landed here until this hour, this land has been governed by men and women of our race. And in fact, the war effort was drenched with racism from end to end. I'll just touch on two aspects, one very briefly, and that's the Yellow Peril psychosis. You can imagine this was revved up fine and dandy at the start of the Pacific War against Japan, to the point where, for example, the Australian commander, General Blamey, described the Japanese soldier as a subhuman beast. That probably doesn't surprise you. What I want to say a little bit more about is the position of indigenous people on this continent. Because if we're talking about the free peoples of Asia, what was the condition of the Aborigines? Well, Doug Nicholls was around in those days, an Aboriginal leader, made a speech in Melbourne in which he said, "Australians are raving about persecuted minorities in other parts of the world, but are they ready to voice their support for the unjustly treated Aboriginal minority in Australia? I saw my people on the Nullarbor Plain begging for food. They seized pieces of apple peel, scraps of bread that were thrown out of the windows and doors. I can never forget it." So this is the reality of the free peoples of Asia. Why then would Aborigines of a political persuasion anyway support the war effort? They wouldn't. William Cooper, another Aboriginal leader, explained this very clearly. He said, "The Aborigine now has no status, no rights, no land, no country. Nothing to fight for but the privilege of defending the land which was taken from him by the white race without compensation or even kindness." Now this begins to raise the specter, I think, of resistance. And the indigenous resistance I want to touch on briefly is Torres Strait Islanders, who were drawn into the military in large numbers relative to their population base. And they were paid £3 a month. White recruits were paid £8 a month. So, you know, pretty outrageous discrimination in this great war for democracy. And the Torres Strait Islanders were sufficiently angry about it. They went on strike, which doesn't sound all that dramatic until you remember that they're in the military and this is wartime. In other words, they mutinied, three companies mutinied, successfully enough to push the right up to two-thirds of the white right. Now, it's a curious figure. How did they arrive at this neat formula of two-thirds of the white right? Obviously, the reality is there was no justification for it whatsoever. It was simply what the authorities had to pay to get the islanders back to work. Why not equal pay? This was a war for democracy. Well, what was the reasoning of white administrators to refuse equal pay? Well, we know because one of them wrote it down. He said, "Although from a strictly legal point of view, the above personnel were entitled to full rates of pay, such payment should not in fact be made. There were two reasons for this. A, the sum involved, and B, that if natives were paid at such rates, it would cause considerable trouble when they eventually left the army." In other words, the expectations would be created of equality in the post-war world, and this is something Australian capitalism had no intention of conceding. But at last we've got to this happier territory of resistance. And we have to make a qualification here. There is nothing like an anti-war movement that we can talk about. There is not even a systematic critique of the war effort put forward by a sizable, you know, influential body of people. But there is a great deal of ferment going on, various fragmentary forms of resistance, which I think are very important to understand. And I think the starting point for it is the economic discontent, anger, the sour mood in the working class coming out of the 1930s depression. The Labour Party, of course, was in a position to know about the mood in the working class, but even so, John Curtin commissioned surveys, experts to go and spend a lot of time in working class communities, find out what the workers think. So we got a pretty good idea, because this is all reported. I'll quote to you. "Workers were in the mass, non-cooperative and resistant to management. They hated employers. There was a fear and lack of confidence in society, leading to passive and active sabotage. Absenteeism resulted from neglect of the workers' needs by the bosses and complete cynicism in relation to them, which manifested itself in browbeating and insufficient detail to industrial welfare." Sour mood. And it finds its reflection in letters to the newspapers. Here's a letter to The Age. "I'm becoming bitterly critical of a system that can readily find millions for war and yet in times of peace does little or nothing to alleviate unemployment with the excuse that money is not available." And now our favorite letter. This is a woman writing to the Director General of Health who had commissioned another survey, this time trying to figure out why the birth rate is too low. A woman writes in. She says, "I believe you desire the reasons of mothers for only having a limited family. Well, one of them is this. What do we owe to Australia? It starved us and our children after the last war, and it will do the same after this one, if we let it. Therefore, we've decided there won't be so many of us to starve this time." And there was anti-war sentiment, particularly initially in organized working class areas. Another researcher, Ellen Walker, went to Cessnock in 1940, mining town, talked to the trade union, the unionized workers there, and also other people. He asked 184 men, "Do you think this is just another capitalistic war?" 26 replied, "Probably," and 49 said, "Of course it is." And so I think you can see here we have the somewhat incoherent but meaningful basis for higher levels of industrial struggle as well. Once the war starts to mop up the unemployment, once workers, you know, the labor market tightens, workers are in a stronger bargaining position, we start to get significant strike, massive coal strike in 1940, but that wasn't the last one. There was coal strikes through the war, right through the Curtin era. And somebody went to John Curtin and said, "Why don't you send the police to arrest these guys? They're going on strike during the war." And he said, "I need a call." They're the only ones that can dig the coal. You know, there's a real labor shortage, and workers knew they were in this position. Major strike by waterside workers clawing back what they'd lost during the 1930s in concessions. Major strike by iron workers. And all of these strikes led by left-wingers, communists primarily, although in Victoria it appears that some of the iron workers' leaders were, seemed to have had some, there seems to be some Trotskyists involved in the state of Victoria as well, people like us, revolutionary socialists. And after a dip in 1942, which results from the immediate invasion scare, you know, shortly after the war, the strike rates rise again and they power on through the through 34, 30, 43, 44, 45, culminating in one sense in an important strike of Balmain iron workers, again led by a Trotskyist. I don't have time to talk about that, but there's a history of working class mobilization in the industrial front during the war. Another important aspect of it is the mobilizations by women workers that are written about in this book, Rebel Women, which is on sale outside. There's a chapter about it. The situation with women workers was that a lot of them had already been working in factories, but a lot more were drawn into industry as a result of the war. And some of them, significant numbers, found themselves in jobs that were previously men's jobs. And so the question then arose, well, what about equal pay? And of course, the Labour Party had been elected on the platform of equal pay. They had no intention of doing anything about it. The pressures are such, though, that the pressure really arises, and Curtin creates a thing called the Women's Employment Board, whose role was to adjudicate on this. And it struck a rate of 90% of the male rate, which is obviously still bitterly unfair, but a lot better, you know, than it might have been otherwise. But the problem was that the employers kept trying to get around it so that workers, women workers had to go on strike just to get this Women's Employment Board rate. And I'll just touch on one of them. At the Alexandria spinning mills in 1943, 1,000 women go out and picket, and then they sent delegations to other factories where they climbed wire grills to reach people working inside. By the end of the week, rank-and-file committees were leading 10,000 workers on strike. And there are many more tales like that about industrial struggle. But what I want to touch on now is more informal forms of resistance, the sort of ferment in society that the war created. It shook things up. It made people confront new ideas and things about themselves. Eric Lambert wrote a novel set in World War II in Australia. He said, "The war turned people inside out. They were unafraid of taboos, and adventures were everyday things." This meant many things, of course, but it meant, just for example, women could get out more. They're more likely to be working. They were more likely to have more money, and it was their own money in the sense that they earned it directly. They could also get out at night without male chaperones and whatever, because the men were off somewhere else, you know, in the war mobilization. And this creates the space for, if you like, more daring behavior, which deeply unsettles the authorities, deeply unsettles them. For example, women were drinking alcohol and having sex. They didn't like it. The authorities didn't like this. "At night, they frequent the streets looking for excitement," said a Victorian policeman. "It strikes me that they have no morals whatsoever." Senator Kane, a Labour Party minister, agreed that it was shocking the way women parked themselves in lounges. So we have, he wanted a crackdown, and he got his crackdown. There were any number of morals crackdowns during the war. A lot of them directed at women, primarily directed at women. But there was also defiance, and this comes through in a novel called Come In Spinner. There's a young woman named Guinea, as her boyfriend has come back from the front, and he confronts her about the fact that the women in Sydney are consorting with Americans and other disreputable elements. And he says, "Have you no decency?" And she replies to him in a passage which is very daring for the literary conventions of the time. She says, "I'll go bag your head. It makes me want to puke when I hear you fellas going on with all this purity bunk. After putting the hard word on all the girls from Sydney to London, and then you come back squealing because there aren't enough virgins left to go around." So we have a little bit of pattern here, I think, of ferment, of crackdowns, and of defiance. And I think we can find the same thing among lesbians and gay men, although it's more difficult to document. The one factor, obviously, is that the concentration of large numbers of people in same-sex environments provided certain opportunities for sexual expression. But what interests me more is more the general way in which people were confronted with new experiences and new ideas they'd never thought of before. It comes through in the story of a young woman who joined the WAF, which is an auxiliary. And she came under suspicion of sexual deviance, and they called her in and they said, "Are you a lesbian?" She said, "No, I'm a Presbyterian." The point, superficially, the point is she didn't know what a lesbian was, okay. But the important thing is that the war had placed her in a position where she might find out. Where she might learn something about herself or other people or the society around her that the authorities did not want her to know. And therefore, it's no surprise, really, I guess, that there was considerably expanded scope for cruising in Sydney on all accounts. There was a bigger bar culture than there had been in the 1930s. This has something to do with also with visiting Americans who'd been in the bar culture of New York and Chicago, or so it seems. And there were crackdowns. But there was also defiance and resistance, and that too comes through in a memoir written by somebody living in King's Cross through the period. It talks about being at a venue, a gay venue, at which there was a flamboyantly dressed man on the platform, and the police come pounding in the doors and raid the place and demand that the man gets off the platform. He refuses. There's a brawl. The policeman gets a flower pot smashed down on his head. Whether this qualifies as a riot, I'm not sure, but there's just this little whiff of Stonewall, you know, in wartime Sydney as well. Then there's the rebellion in the military. I'm starting to move toward the end now. Very interesting topic, the military rebellion. A lot of which has to do with the class-ridden nature of the Australian Army. Now, you may have heard the Australian Army is more democratic than the Brits, and, you know, maybe a little bit. But there's no doubt whatsoever that, by and large, it was class-ridden. There was all the available data indicates that the officers came from relatively privileged backgrounds. And once you were an officer, you got a servant. You got a baton to do all the shit work for you. And moreover, there was this prejudice against working class people who did start out more likely as privates or whatever, who proved themselves under fire, they still couldn't get promoted. They couldn't rise through the ranks. And what this meant was a ridiculous situation where units would go into combat led by officers who had no combat experience. When there were available rank and file leaders who could have done it much more effectively, you consider this as your life is at stake going into combat. You can imagine the anger and frustration that this caused. Other things as well, food. Not just the quality of the food, there was plenty of complaints that there were mutinies over the quality of the food. But the fact that there are things in the memoirs where the officers are sitting at the table eating and we're sitting on the floor. You know, the class nature of the military. So there are upheavals. These are just from Western Australia alone. At one army camp, a sit-down strike for a day and a half. At another, 2,000 to 3,000 troops holding mass meetings and boycotting parades. A strike at a third camp. And there were mutinies on ships. There are 5-6 mutinies on ships that we know about. One of them so explosive, the HMAS Westralia, that the captain had to train a machine gun on the crew to keep it under control. There's also, again, the informal ferment going on. Just one story here about going to the cinema. If you were a soldier and you went to the cinema, who turned up on the screen first? The king. You're supposed to applaud. And then the prime minister turns up and you're supposed to applaud. And then the soldiers would yell, "What about Joe Stalin?" Mm-hmm. Now, Joe Stalin was the leader of the Soviet Union, which was an ally. He was the leader of the international communist movement. And I've heard these stories for a long time, and communists will tell you this shows how pro-Soviet and pro-communist the soldiers were. And there's some truth in that. But what I've become more aware of in my research is that actually a lot of soldiers did this with no particular conscious political intent at all. They just knew yelling, "What about Joe Stalin?" gave the officers the shits. That does not mean the communists were not important. There were 3,000 to 4,000 communists in the military. They were extremely well organized. They were considerably better organized than the British or American communists. They had a district committee in Port Moresby and branches throughout the region behind the lines, a series of groups studying Marxist economics right in the middle of the war, and also in North Queensland, where they brought together large numbers of people for training purposes, communists were able to hold a conference of 50 branch delegates from different branches around the military. So a significant organization. And unfortunately, they didn't do anything revolutionary with that organization. I'll come back and touch on that in a second. But you can see how the raw material was there for ultimately some kind of anti-war movement. But there was no anti-war movement. And neither was there a systematic critique put forward by any sizable organization, sizable social force in Australia. And this needs some explanation. The first factor is undoubtedly the yellow peril psychosis. You know, that revved up this racism against Japan, intensive racist agitation. Because to set up an anti-war movement is really very helpful if you have some concept of solidarity with the people on the other side, solidarity with the Japanese working class. This was very difficult to generalize given the racist agitation. A second factor was the understandable but quite mistaken fear that the Japanese were going to invade and occupy the country. Now, that would have been a pretty scary prospect. But we know for a fact now that Japanese had no plans to invade Australia. And moreover, we know that John Curtin knew, the Australian government knew, as early as sometime in April 1942. But Curtin and the Australian government went on pretending to the Australian public for the best part of a year that there was some kind of invasion danger in order to extract sacrifices out of the Australian working class. So that's the second factor. The third factor is an equally understandable but equally mistaken belief that the war against Japan was a war against fascism. Now, the fact is, I've gone into this in some detail, the Japanese regime was not a fascist regime. There were elections during the war, and there were opposition candidates, and some of them got elected. There were changes of government during the war. There was various forms of other dissent. So, I think you could reasonably say the Japanese regime was an authoritarian regime. But how was it more authoritarian than the colonial regimes that had been run by the Western imperialists all throughout Asia before the Second World War? So that argument was bogus, but it had its impact. And the reason it had its impact was the role of the Communist Party. This would be a whole discussion itself, but I need to say something about it. You would have looked to the Communists as the starting point for anti-war agitation. But at crucial turning points, the Communists were full-on in support of the war. This is because the Communist Party had Stalinist politics. It essentially means that they were turned into agents for Soviet foreign policy, for Russian foreign policy. The Soviet Union, being in the war in Europe, instructed the Communist parties to form alliances with their local ruling classes in their own countries. And so in Australia, the Communist Party is looking for what was called a People's Front, an alliance with, for example, the Labour Party, but also other people who were quite bourgeois. And this then meant, effectively, they had to be part of the anti-war movement, including the war against Japan. And this led to a political degeneration to the point where they were even engaging in racist agitation against the Japanese. And the reason why this matters so much for us is that it highlights the importance of revolutionary ideas and revolutionary organization. So through the course of this weekend, when people say to you, they plead with you, we need you to join our organization if you're not already a member and help us build something with the right politics, this is a good example in World War II of what happens if you fail to do that, why it's so important. So in any case, what we have, therefore, in the end, is no anti-war movement and no coherent critique of the resistance. And this is a tragedy, because what has come down to us is this idealized, sanitized, romanticized picture of the war as a wonderful crusade, which has very little connection with reality, but which is incredibly useful to our rulers in lining us up for the next war. And so if you want to campaign against the wars of today and the wars of tomorrow, you need to know what was wrong with the Great War of yesterday, and that's why I'm here talking about today, this morning.